I'm here with Peter Steinfels, whose long story, The Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report, Not What It Seems, is now featured on our website and is also the cover story of our January 25th issue. Peter, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
You open your piece by bringing the reader back to last August 2018, when Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro released a pretty startling grand jury report declaring hundreds of Catholic priests in six Pennsylvania dioceses had been abusing children for decades while bishops, quote, not only did nothing but hid it all. What was your reaction at the time to the findings of this report and to the media's coverage of it?
Well, first of all, I was shocked by a lot of the contents in the report, as I think any sensitive person, especially a Catholic, would be. I was shocked, but I wasn't really surprised, because I'd been following the sex abuse scandal story for 30 years since essentially I started work as a senior religion reporter at the New York Times in 1988. And so I was – my second reaction was a little bit of shock and a little bit of surprise that so many people took this as utterly fresh news. In 2004 and 2011, the John Jay College of Criminal Justice had made two major studies showing that 4 to 5% of the American Catholic clergy since 1950 had been guilty of sexual abuse. And so it wasn't news. And if you had been reading and watching TV in 2002, when the Boston Globe presented its exposés of particularly what had gone on in the Boston Archdiocese, you would have seen these terrible stories about the pain and long-term devastating impact of sexual abuse on minors, especially when it was perpetrated by someone intimately responsible for the victim, like parents, or someone with a special religious aura, like priests. So I was a little surprised and shocked by that. Mm-hmm. Finally, I was a little disappointed by the media coverage. I've had to write stories within hours of long and complicated encyclicals by Pope John Paul II. Mm-hmm. So I sympathize with reporters who were faced with an 884-page document, which not only they but no one else had seen until they were at the press conference when it was released. However, I was disappointed when there was no real follow-up and examination on when more time was available mm-hmm. of the contents of that report.
Mm-hmm. So was it just then this elapse of time and this sort of gap of time following the report's release that you said, well, how come there's no follow-up here? Is this when you decided to take a closer look?
I think I decided to take a closer look when I became familiar with the language and extent of the charges that were presented in the first 12-page introduction of the report, mm-hmm. which I have to say seemed to have been the basis of a good 90% or more of all the media coverage, whether in print or on television. Those charges, I'm not concerned. I'm not addressing the questions of the charges against predatory priests. But what leapt out at me was the charges against bishops and other church officials about how they handled allegations over this 70-year period, mm-hmm. a long period, and the charges were extraordinary. Mm-hmm. They were that all victims had been brushed aside by all officials everywhere. They were, as you said, the charge that priests were raping little boys and girls, and that the church officials had done nothing except to hide it all. That was extraordinary language that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court itself, in an opinion later, called incendiary. Mm-hmm. And actually, I called a friend who's a contributor to Commonweal, who more familiar with covering crime in courts, and said, what do you think? You're a veteran at this. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this language? And his description of it was with the phrase shock and awe. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I said to myself, is this really substantiated or not? I wasn't imagining that in fact, the absolute opposite was the truth, that no bishops mm-hmm. had brushed aside victims. No bishops had hid to protect the abuser's reputation or the church institutions what had been allegated. Mm-hmm. But I really was taken aback by the sweeping and indiscriminate nature of these charges. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, normally this would deserve fact-checking. Mm. So I set about that. Mm.
So you find yourself in, I guess, possession of the report that's many pages, hundreds of pages. And in fact, I think you mentioned this story too. There's a discrepancy. It's several right. hundred pages, but also possibly 1,300 pages. You right. find yourself in possession of this and you're pouring through it. And were your hunches sort of confirmed quickly, or was it sort of through the slow accretion of detail as you're making your way through this that you began to think, wait a second, there is something different here that the 12-page introduction seems to obscure?
Yes, I thought not only that the introduction obscured it, but the reader, including myself, was kind of bludgeoned by agreement to the introduction by two factors. One was the sheer bulk of the report that you've referred to. The second was the sheer awfulness of the crimes and sins against children and young people that were described. So my reaction was, I've got to start systematically checking dates, when abuse occurred, when allegations came in, and then actions. What did a given bishop or church official do about it? And faced with hundreds and hundreds of pages profiling offenders, I decided that the best method was, first of all, to drill down on one diocese, which I did, mm-hmm. and then later check to see, by sampling hundreds and hundreds of other pages, whether that diocese was an outlier. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point that I reached the conclusion that the report, in fact, is grossly misleading, inaccurate, and really unjust.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the way your piece is constructed as well, you acknowledge – well, you take care to stress that what you're focusing on is not the documenting of the crimes and the acts committed by priests – but the characterization of the handling of these cases is a cover-up. And I think that's important for readers and listeners to hear that what it is you're actually tackling in this story.
It's absolutely important. I have, since first having to examine this whole issue, read scores and scores of victims' description of the impact that this kind of abuse made on their lives, which are terrible. I have spoken with individuals who have had this experience. I just am very concerned that it not be – these two things not be confused, mm-hmm. the charges against the predatory priests on the one hand and the charges against the bishops and other church officials on the other hand. Do I know that, in fact, all the charges against all the predatory priests are, in fact, true? I have a suspicion that there are probably some innocent people whose names have been taken in vain by the grand jury report. But that's not really my concern. And I personally suspect that there are very few out of the 300 that were named.
Mm. I want to get back to something you mentioned a moment ago about the setup of the organization of the report, which you describe as effective, which I thought is an interesting word, effective, lopsided, and unwieldy. Talk a little bit about how the organization of the report itself obscures some of its true content while also hindering or discouraging the kind of deeper analysis you attempted.
Well, the report, of course, features its introduction, and then it features an overview of the six dioceses that were investigated. And in the case of each diocese, there are three often very grotesque, even sacrilegious examples of abuse of minors by priests. So all that is highlighted. Mm-hmm. There are, in fact, in the report, and I should back up and say that highlighting is what makes the report effective. Yeah. Secondly, however, the report is lopsided in the sense that it devotes 500 even far more than that, pages to describing abusing priests. It only devotes a few pages to analyzing in any systematic way the responses of church officials, nor does it even analyze greater patterns among the abusing priests. Like, for example, how many priests were serving in those six dioceses over that very extended period of time? Something we would like to know about. We would like to know what percentage of priests were abusers of the total percentage that were serving. So there's a lot of things that we're missing. And then when I said it was, my word, it was not lopsided.
Unwieldy. Yeah.
You had this 884 pages, which were presented as the report from the grand jury. But that was followed by over 400 pages, adding up to 1,356 of responses that came in from the diocese, and some of them from priests who were protesting their innocence. And basically, these were all photocopied, and I think the fair word would be dumped at the end of the report. In fact, if you go to the website of the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office, you won't even find those essentially important responses from people who were named on their website PDF.
So just to clarify, where did these other pages come from then? You got them in hard copy, or how? If it's not available on the website, how did you come into it?
The PDF of the report was available through many outlets, Pennsylvania newspapers primarily and otherwhere. And some of them had the full 1,356 pages. But of course, if you were – whether you were paging through in a printout or whether you were online, that meant that you had to say online, you had to examine a profile of an offending priest, then scroll through hundreds of pages to find out if the diocese or the officials had any critique or response or explanation of what the grand jury report said had been done, and go back and forth in that way. So it was very time-consuming and daunting, and quite frankly, I was sometimes unhappy that I wasn't a New York Times team of reporters to do this, but only a single individual.
That's a good point. I want to get back, too, to something you alluded to a moment ago about the time span the report covers. And certainly I think a number of us, when this news was breaking in the summer of 2018, thought, wow, 70 to 80 years. Unbelievable. 70 to 80 years this report covers. But you point out that the very fact of this time span makes, in your words, for some memorable cases, including one in which allegations made against a priest born the year that U.S. Grant was president, ordained the year that Teddy Roosevelt led the Rough Riders up San Juan Hill, and who died when Harry Truman was president. The allegation came to light only in 2006, more than half a century after this priest's death. But you note that in treating these seven or so decades as a block, the report exhibits no sense of history or context. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, that was one of the things that came across in going through the whole report, which was not only what was there, but what wasn't there. I mean, just imagine a report on a subject like American family stability from 1945 to 2018, or on race relations in America from World War II to the present, or on environmental pollution or conditions over 70 or 80 years. You would have to look at lots of developments in the whole culture, in our politics, in this case, our understanding of sexual abuse, of its extent, of its nature, of its impact, and how to handle it. Now, that has changed a lot over this period of time. There's no sense of that at all in the report. And not only that, there are some important and in one case landmark developments that are never really taken into account. The Catholic Church leadership began to wise up that sexual abuse of minors was not just a case of bad apples, but a systemic problem in the 1980s and through the 1990s. And they finally promulgated the Dallas Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People following the Boston Globe's exposés in June of 2002. Mm-hmm. Now, that was really a change. And it's if you were looking at, say, race relations in the United States, and you didn't give real attention to the civil rights movement, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and so on, you'd just be off base. Mm-hmm. And essentially, that's what this report does. It notes the Dallas Charter here and there, but essentially it does so in a way to minimize it and not to show its major importance.
I do want to return to the years since the promulgation of the Charter in 2002. But before we do that, I think there's something very interesting about your story, and this is something you'd alluded to in prior conversations. But you raised concerns about the very nature of this kind of report, a grand jury investigative report. Why is it important for people to know just what this term means vis-a-vis the naming of names and concepts like due process and innocence until proof of guilt?
Yes, I think that most people and most readers of stories about this report fail to understand its limitations. The normal purpose of a grand jury report in history has always been to protect people from being subject to arrest and trial without sufficient cause. So grand juries usually investigate some incident to decide whether to indict a person. If a person is indicted, then that person has his or her day in court with cross-examination of witnesses and all the things that are necessary to produce a regular trial. However, an investigative or investigating grand jury report takes on some issue with no real intention or ability to indict people. Therefore, in a sense, the report is in itself a conclusion rather just than a prelude to a testing of whether somebody is guilty or not guilty. And I think when a grand jury investigating report also names people who will never have their day in court, in this case, not only the predatory priests about whom I have to confess I'm less concerned, but about bishops and church officials whose names were also presented, whose responses then were essentially ignored. Mm-hmm. I think that's a serious problem, which people have to realize and which puts a burden on others to respond to the report once it's issued. Now, I point out something here. The bishops themselves, because some of them and many of their predecessors are, in fact, failed in their responses to allegations of sexual abuse, the bishops really have a credibility problem on the one hand. And on the other hand, they have a pastoral responsibility not to do anything that would increase the pain of victims. And therefore, they're not in a position to respond. That leaves it to the media, to civil libertarians, to scholars who would look at it. And I'm afraid that that responsibility hasn't been taken up in this case.
This was, I guess, sort of the initial types of these reports and investigative efforts launched by a state attorney general. And there's indication now that more are to follow in other states. In fact, Illinois, I guess, has undertaken one, and perhaps a dozen more states are thought to be doing so. And even the U.S. Department of Justice might be getting into the act, I think, as you put it in the story. What does this portend maybe for the next year or two or three in this regard on this topic?
I think that's a very important point, and it's one of the reasons why I, took, in fact, months of work on this article, because I think unless people understand the dynamics of this kind of report, they will not necessarily be receiving the truth. Mm-hmm. And these reports could be done well, but my argument is only if they're done in a very different way than the Pennsylvania grand jury report was done, mm-hmm. that we will possibly get a very false image of the way that church leaders, particularly in the last 30 years, but particularly since 2002, have carried out their responsibilities. We'll get a false picture of whether our children or grandchildren are safe in mm-hmm. Catholic institutions. And we'll also be probably engaged in lots of further lawsuits. I don't take any position on the question of civil lawsuits by victims from many years ago. Mm-hmm. You can argue that one way or another. Mm-hmm. But I do think there is an argument about the responsibility of church institutions, of their charities, of their parish life, and so on, mm-hmm. to even be made bankrupt because of things done long ago.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess we are talking about notions of statutes of limitations on charges from the past as well, yeah?
Yes, I think that, again, I'm not delving into that argument, just like I'm not delving into lots of other things, the charges against Cardinal McCarrick mm-hmm. or Archbishop Vigano's charges about the Vatican. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to stick to this and this alone. So the grand jury report in the case of Pennsylvania makes four recommendations. One of them has to do with removing statutes of limitations for criminal charges, and I don't see any problem with that. Maybe lawyers would. There's two other ones, one that has to do with sealing documents in lawsuits. The other one has to do with reporting allegations to law enforcement officials. Mm-hmm. The one which I would call radioactive is the one about removing the statute of limitations for civil lawsuits by victims who are now 30 years old or more for things that happened in the past. Now, the actual proposal is to have a window under which such people mm-hmm. for a period of, say, 2 years could begin lawsuits. Mm-hmm. Again, there's an arguable case for that. There's a case against it. There is a problem, however, that these old lawsuits, which are often against priests that are even deceased, mm-hmm. church officials who may be deceased or not active, are very hard to deal with except in an arbitrary way. And the reality is they're often tried in the court of public opinion rather than in the judicial process itself. Mm-hmm. So I have mixed feelings about that. I just think that in order to push the political process to open a window like that, the grand jury in Pennsylvania has simplified and distorted, in a sense, weaponized this grand jury investigation. And that's what I'm concerned about, because I think that the impression for the general public, and especially for Catholics, that results is inaccurate. Mm.
You know, I think for some folks, that's going to be kind of difficult to hear. And you take care in your piece to anticipate and, I guess, validate potential resistance to your analysis of this report. I think the words you use, you say that you're in. It's an inquiry that you admit that for many angry and dismayed Catholics flies in the face of overpowering headwinds, since questioning the report can be read as excusing the crimes that the church is accused of committing. And I'm wondering, and this is probably a very difficult question. I'm not sure anybody will get to the answer soon, but why is there such anger still, and why even when there is something like a reasoned analysis of the construction and presentation of a report, resistance to accepting such an analysis or even entertaining such an analysis?
That's a very important question. And I think the first answer is the horror and proper horror we have at this kind of crime. Mm-hmm. That creates strong feelings, mm-hmm. that makes it very hard mm-hmm. to entertain any distinctions about responsibility. Mm-hmm. Because of that, there's also become an established script mm-hmm. in how clergy sex abuse, particularly Catholic clergy sex abuse, is viewed and understood. That script arises from the fact that there's a certain convergence between the desire of litigators to find some recompense for victims from the past and recompense which will only be found in the one source available, which are the supposedly deep pockets of dioceses and of insurance companies. And on the other hand, the storytelling needs of the media. So that has resulted in a single script that poses negligible and knowledgeable bishops who purposely shuffled priests who they knew were dangerous to children from parish to parish versus the victims. That's part of the story, but it's only part. Mm-hmm. The history of this abuse crisis is much more complicated than that. The other thing that your question raises, why there's such resistance to examining this in any degree of calm, is that our church is also roiled by a lot of other questions, mm-hmm. Everything from the clerical culture to celibacy to how women are treated mm-hmm. in the church, contraception, mm-hmm. same-sex marriage, you name it, there are divisions among Catholics. I am not addressing them. I have written about those elsewhere and not with a particular glow regarding the leadership of the bishops. But those are separate questions. They do, however, play into the difficulty in approaching this with any degree of calm and making any distinctions about responsibilities.
Yeah, I think that might sort of factor into how you take up this next question, because you end the piece by expressing your belief in the progress that the American church has made on this front since the years that are detailed in the report. And while you note the accuracy of the report in identifying institutional failure, you also speak to the institutional success of the Dallas Charter of 2002. I want you to talk a little bit more about the charter and this as what you describe as its success. And I also am wondering, why do you think the story of the progress made since the adoption of the charter just isn't getting through?
Well, I think because there are these continuing instances of at least apparent, maybe very real failures mm-hmm. by church leaders, not only a handful here in the United States, but more and more coming from over 3,000 dioceses around the world, mm-hmm. of failures to sufficiently protect children. Mm-hmm. Those failures now, in the way they're conveyed to people, often blur the line between things that are current and things that are from decades in the past. And as I said, they're now international. Right. So that keeps the story alive. Now, every year or 2 years, the Bishops' Conference gathers together an audit mm-hmm. of extensive examination of preventive programs and of allegations and how they were handled from all the almost 200 dioceses and jurisdictions in the United States. That's not really a story. Mm-hmm. I think that if most people could see the graph of sexual abuse as the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and other studies have shown, mm-hmm. and how it began to go up in the 60s, spiked in the 70s, began to drop down in the 80s. If they could see that graph with the number of cases that mm-hmm. really have come to light and been dealt with really quite decisively since 2002, they would be surprised at the dramatic change that has taken place.
I think, is it true that in the case of the Pennsylvania grand jury report, is it true that it's only three cases are represented in that report since 2002?
There are two cases, and the report manages to refer to them any number of times, which I think is an indication of the report's desire to minimize the impact of the Dulles Charter, and again to meld together this question in all places, at all times, under all bishops, partly because that's an effective way of making the case for opening a window to civil lawsuits against the church.
I'm not sure you will have an answer to this, but have you heard anything yet from the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office, or do you anticipate hearing from them, or do you anticipate a reaction?
I anticipate all kinds of reactions from the Attorney General's office or the Attorney General, a blitz of condemnations and congratulations on social media and so on. I contacted the Attorney General's office but dealt with their press person and tried to get as many answers as I could about the actual process and methods. He was working under the constraints that the state law governing grand juries, as is usually the case elsewhere, keep most of these matters secret. But I really didn't attempt to get to the Attorney General himself, and I'd be surprised if there was no reaction.
It's not necessarily that I want to put you into the position of prognosticating, but we're several weeks out now from the Bishops' Summit at the Vatican on sex abuse in February. Do you have any thoughts about how they might take up the issue there and what might come from it?
That's a very difficult question, because over the many years that I have paid attention to this, and particularly since 2002, I've become very aware of the worldwide dimensions of this issue and how different cultures, different governments, different law enforcement agencies and traditions deal with it, and therefore how hard it will be for the church to develop some kind of universal, specific guidelines or ways of approaching this. And that makes me pained to say that I'm not sure how much can be done in a brief meeting in February other than to raise consciousness. Whether consciousness can be raised to meet the high expectations for that meeting, which are already out there and against which its outcome will be measured is something that I'm not terribly optimistic about. In the long run, I think the church, but all sorts of other institutions as well, have to develop methods for dealing with these kind of questions in different kinds of contexts and different cultural moments, if you will.
There's also a portion in the piece where you speak about your own experience confronting sexual abuse of minors in an institutional setting.
Well, the only thing that I might add, because I've written for Commonweal about my own experience in the summer when I turned 17, of making the discovery that the second-to-top official at the Boy Scout camp where I was working was actually abusing 14-year-old, quote, trainees or interns on the staff, and how I did manage with some drama to get that information to higher-ups, and the person was duly fired. But through an extraordinary coincidence, I found that after he had moved, since he was a teacher, to a different state and continued his teaching career, he continued to abuse. That has made me very conscious of the difficulties surrounding this question and, over time, the changes. This happened 6 decades ago when there were not yet mandatory reporting laws, when people wanted to treat this as totally hush-hush. Therapists didn't know what to do about it. Law enforcement would tend not to want to touch it, and so on. And I welcome the changes that have taken place in our culture and belatedly in the Catholic Church about these things. But it's been long and difficult, and I think, however, we should take it into account.
Peter Steinfeld's analysis of the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report is now featured on our website under the headline, "The Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report, Not What It Seems," and it's also the cover story of our January 25th issue. Thanks, Peter, for being here.
You're quite welcome.